You know, all you have to do is look up in the sky at any given day, and you will see chemtrails. You will see these vapor lines, whatever they are. They're up there. You know, you wake up in the morning, and it might be a beautiful blue sky, but by the mid-afternoon, it looks cloudy with chemtrails. In a moment, Clifford Carnicom, our special guest. We're going to talk with him about chemtrails. I'm also going to ask him about this incredible story about the disappearing bees and if he thinks chemtrails might be a cause for that. We're back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Clifford Carnicom has been a professional computer consultant for the past 10 years. He resides in Santa Fe, New Mexico. He originated, developed, and maintains a very high-traffic, environmental, and socially conscious website and public discussion forum. He was previously a research scientist and federal employee for 15 years with three different agencies, the United States Department of Defense, the Bureau of Land Management, and the U.S. Forest Service. His website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. It is Carnicom. I'll spell it for you. Carnicom.com. Clifford Carnicom. Hi, Clifford. How are you?
Good evening, George. And very well. And thank you very much for the invitation and opportunity to be here tonight.
Clifford, I'm going to ask you, how did you get interested? How did you begin to investigate the chemtrails?
My work started at the very beginning of 1999. The first photograph I posted was on Valentine's Day, February 14th, 1999. And that was preceded, that date was preceded by a couple of months of things happening at a more subconscious level. It was really, my wife and I spend quite a bit of time outside, and we typically go out for the weekend and go camping and such, and in fact, photography was going on quite a bit at the time. And there was a pattern, and again, this was somewhat at an undercurrent level. We really wasn't aware exactly what was happening there. For about a month and a half, we would have breakfast, wake up to a beautiful Santa Fe, high desert climate, clear weather, absolutely beautiful. It's known for the artists being here because of the spectacular vistas. And we would get ready to head out, and things would look just fine, and we would have breakfast. And maybe about an hour to an hour and a half later, we would head out. And we would notice that the weather had changed in a very dramatic and uncharacteristic fashion within an hour and a half. Again, that was more at a subconscious level until about through about a month and a half. There was a day when I was sort of in the process of going outside in the middle of that period. And I stepped outside, and at that point, the presence of aircraft operations became immediately noticeable to me as being very unusual what was happening, because this transformation of an absolutely ideal weather conditions was being transformed in a matter of an hour. And that's when I started taking my photographs. And what happened that day was I stopped. That was the difference. I just stopped. I stood outside, and I just watched overhead, particularly focusing on a single trail emission. And I watched the transformation take place, and I photographed that. And, in fact, those photographs are still on the site and are of the introductory session to my work, basically, and they show this transformation over roughly a half hour.
Well, you know, the old days, Clifford, we used to say, on a clear day, you can see forever. I can't remember, Clifford, a clear day anymore.
Well, we have changed our planet. This is just a fact now. It's beyond the point of wondering whether or not we could have an effect. It's beyond the point of wondering whether an experiment is taking place. Our planet has been transformed. And, you know, to illustrate that difference, as you're saying by the common phrase, you can see clear forever. In terms of actual physics, if you look at visibility related to the atmosphere, a clean, clear atmosphere, it is very common, very easy to see roughly 90 to 120 miles. Today was an excellent demonstration of the stage and level of damage that has been done, because in Santa Fe today, particularly resulting from heavy operations that have taken place over the last 2 to 3 weeks, the Santa Fe Mountains, which rise up to 12,000 feet, you know, 5 miles outside of town, these mountains were literally only partially visible today. It was just, it's an amazing change that has taken place. And it is a fact that we have our planet now transformed, and visibility is one of your first clues. If you care to look at the simple common sense of what's going on, something is in the air and you're looking through it and you can no longer see forever.
You know, Cliff, aerosol crimes is what you call this, and of course that's got an obvious connotation. Why did you say that?
Because I do regard it as a crime really of the highest nature, a truly an infringement of the greatest magnitude upon the human race. This is not even anything that we can restrict to a country or a place. You have a crime, a criminal act, basically the usurping and pollution of the very lifeblood of human beings and all life on this planet. It has now been dominated by a series of forces, partially known and much unknown, where what many would consider to be divine rights have been taken away from us.
Well, you know, I'm going to open up the phone lines later on tonight, Clifford, and I'm going to call it the whistleblower line. Maybe, just maybe, we'll get pilots or some government officials who know what the heck is going on there. They may be able to help corroborate some of the things you're going to talk with us about tonight.
That could be helpful, and I appreciate the opportunity to do that. At this point, most of the information that has come forth has been acquired painstakingly over a great period of time, with no significant direct lead-ins or whistleblowers being apparent.
How can we tell the difference, Cliff, between chemtrails and normal jet vapor trails?
Well, George, you'll notice that I actually don't use the word chemtrail. I know that it's quite the popular term, and that's just
right.
Fine. And I understand that. But in terms of making this distinction, this would be a part of it, and that is to get to the definitions of things and to the very nature of what's going on. Let's distinguish first between a contrail and a cloud, because that's really the beginning of this. A contrail, by definition, is condensed water. It came from a junction of two words, condensed and trail. It is, by definition, composed of water vapor. In principle, this is no different than, you know, asking yourself, what happens to you when you're outside on an extremely cold winter day and you breathe? What happens to that breath? Okay, what happens to that water vapor that comes out of a heated chamber, namely your body in this case? That water, if it's cold enough, can freeze, certainly. But what you will see is a combination of evaporation, dissipation, and certainly mixing. That will mix and dissipate in an environment fairly quickly because you're dealing with the transformation of water from a solid to a liquid state. It's not that difficult in terms of its basic physical premise. If you had a car, an automobile, driving down the street on the freeway in a winter day in Michigan, would you expect to see a trail lasting, 100 miles that was
No. You'd see it for a little bit. You definitely will see it when he stopped at a red light, but once he gets going, it generally dissipates.
Okay, so this is water vapor, and this is what, by definition, a contrail is. It's a common, normal phenomenon that has existed since aircraft were able to reach high altitude.
It doesn't stay up there forever.
Not under any normal situation whatsoever. I've actually looked at the extreme conditions under which things can, be so-called persistent. And you're just dealing with a set of circumstances that are so unusual that they defy any type of ordinary explanation that is attempted to be attributed to it. In contrast, a cloud requires two things, two main things. It requires moisture, and it also requires particles. There have to be very small particles, they call them condensation nuclei, to exist in the air for clouds to form. Clouds will typically form at mid-altitudes, call it 10, 15, 20,000 feet, because that's where those conditions exist. A contrail does not require excessive moisture. It does not require particulate material in the sky. In fact, the conditions for contrail formation are very cold, clean, and dry air. These are ideal conditions for contrail formation. Moisture is not the factor. The moisture in the air is not the factor in terms of its development or existence.
Okay, we're going to do kind of a flashback with you today because we're going to back into the reasons. I want you to tell us now what you think these are.
Well, these emissions are composed primarily by the best evidence that I can provide through over 7 years of research, predominantly of submicron sized metallic salts. This appears without any question to be a dominant component of these emissions. And this is why I will use the word aerosol, because that is an accurate term and is the best term that I can come up to describe what's actually going on.
All right, we'll call it aerosol tonight, Cliff. What is the purpose of these aerosol sprays?
Well, that's a pretty loaded question. I'm going to do my best to answer it for you. I know people often want a soundbite answer. In my case,
no, this is a three-hour show. We don't need a soundbite answer tonight.
Well, that's great. I appreciate it, because in my case, over 7 years of work, I have arrived at a list of seven, what you can call them, potential agendas. You can call them endeavors, whatever you want to call them, motives. But each of these is consistent with all of the data that has accumulated over 7 years. One of the problems is that you cannot take a single answer unless it is consistent with all of the data that's available. And to come up with a list of seven of those has been a very long, arduous process. But that list, in brief, is number one, that of environmental modification and control. The second would, and weather, certainly weather modification is one aspect of that, not even all of it. Second would be those of biological operations. The third would be military operations. The fourth would be electromagnetic operations. The fifth would be the consideration of actually geophysical, actually planetary effects. Our global effects are not impossible with what's going on here. The sixth would be the development of a surveillance system that uses what is called LIDAR versus radar. And the last would be the detection of what you could call exotic propulsion systems or unusual propulsion systems within the air. Now, that's my list of seven, and each of those is worthy, certainly, of a very extended conversation.
All right, we will digest each one. Now, of all these seven, are they all made for the betterment of mankind? I mean, is this doing us good? Is that why they're doing it, to help us?
Actually, unfortunately, there is actually no evidence. I wish I could say so, but there is no evidence that anything here amongst this operation is benevolent to this planet or the inhabitants of it. This is just the evidence does not show benevolence. The evidence indicates domination and control.
Interesting. Now, do you think the pilots of these aircraft know what's going on?
No, not at the level, of the true intent of the operation. Not by any means. I do regard and classify this as a covert operation, without any question, a covert operation of the grandest scale that you could ever imagine. Certainly has all the attributes of a Manhattan Project or larger in terms of how it's handled. And with any covert project, you have layers and layers and layers of security and secrecy. And there is absolutely no reason whatsoever to regard the pilots as being particularly privy to the true nature of these operations. In fact, it would every much be expected that the pilots would encompass one of those many, many layers of secrecy, and quite possibly issue information which could be entirely false and misleading without any ill will or intent in the process.
Is this worldwide, or is it just happening here in the United States?
Oh, it absolutely is a global operation. The planet has been affected. You know, the atmosphere, it's more delicate than we have given credit for. When this first started, I really didn't know whether or not the atmosphere of the planet could be altered. I really didn't, but it's quite obvious that it can. And part of the reason for that is the atmosphere is there's not as much as we think there is. We are surrounded by a very delicate, thin shell. Three-quarters of the mass of the atmosphere is within 7 miles of the Earth. If you were 6 feet high, roughly analogy would be roughly a 16th inch thick. This is an eggshell surrounding us, and it has been and is quite possible, and it has been done, that literally the physical constitution of that atmosphere has been changed. It's a fluid medium, and therefore particulates, aerosols, which are particles in suspension, they will eventually seek an equilibrium in distribution. And just as if you were to put a a drop of dye in a bathtub, there would be a slight temp that would eventually resolve itself. The same thing will happen with the atmosphere. These materials will eventually distribute themselves fairly evenly, and they have done so. There are a few countries in which information is not forthcoming at all, traditionally regarded as the communist bloc countries, and so we don't actually have little to no information about whether or not the actual operations take place there, but it doesn't really matter in the sense that the scale of the operating is large enough that the entire planet has been affected.
Moving to this country, Clifford, of the 50 states, are all of them getting hit on a regular basis, or some more than others?
I have no geographical location in this country that I know of that can be considered immune from these operations. There may be periods of time in which certain regions or certain areas may be less active than others, but I do believe that there is a need and a desire to maintain a certain concentration level of these particulates or aerosols in the atmosphere. And so it's a matter basically of logistics of causing this to happen. It is an interesting observation and quite true that there are periods and definite emphasis that is often placed on urban areas. And that's an interesting observation, by no means restricted or to urban areas, but there are times when it is quite obvious that the primary intent of coverage at that time is an urban area.
Daytime more than nighttime?
No real reason to think that at this point. And also in terms of when we have cloud cover, there are many times when we are totally ignorant as to what the real state of affairs is up there. There's good reason to believe that these operations were commenced up in the northwestern U.S. in the mid-90s as opposed to 98, which is generally given as the starting point for these operations, at least in a scale. That's an area of extremely dense cloud cover in general, and quite possible that the operations could have been conducted, and there's reason to believe that they were conducted in dense cloud cover regions in which the population would not even really be very aware that these were taking place. So I really cannot draw distinctions between nighttime or daytime in any restrictive sense to say that it's only happening there. Certainly night operations have been observed. Most of us are not, awake or outside nearly as much to be able to notice or see as well. Your visibility is limited. There's simply, from my standpoint, I see no restriction in geographic location or time across the board.
Cliff, if someone suspects that they see these aerosol sprays above, what should they do? Head for cover, or is there anything they can do?
I wish I could give folks easy answers to some of these things, but I can't, because you're talking about your very air supply.
This is everything,
this,
right?
This is not something you can go in your little hideout or go up to the Northwoods of Michigan and think that you're out of the woods on this.
Yeah.
It is your air supply. Look at the hierarchy of what it takes to survive. How long are you going without your air supply? And if your air supply is affected, where are you going to feel it first in terms of as a living organism? As breathing is about the most fundamental thing that we can speak of, and I wish that I could offer some refuge for us. I have none. If I could, I would. I have no refuge. You're talking about dominating our air supply without the human consent. In a way that is difficult for many of us certainly to conceive, and certainly many of us refuse to accept it, even in the light of sufficient and overwhelming evidence.
Okay, Cliff, you stay with us. We're going to be right back with you. Cliff's website, again, is carnicom.com. If you have a computer, get up to coasttocoastam.com right now. Take a look at some of the aerosol spray pictures that he supplied us. They really are remarkable. We'll be back with him. We're going to digest some of these 7 points that we talked about. And then later on, we will take your phone calls and open up a whistleblower hotline as well. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest, Clifford Carnicom. We're going to take your calls later on tonight, so get ready for that Cliff, let's talk also as we get into these seven major aspects of what you think they might be. Tell me about the evidence behind it. How did you come to your beliefs that these issues were caused by these particular seven items we talked about earlier?
Well, the first thing that I would want to clarify, George, is that I by no means regard this work of myself as well as countless others as a belief system. And that's not meant as any kind of slight. It's simply meant as clarification. A belief system, you know, is based upon something that we can't observe, but we might feel or think about something. This is not a belief system that is being spoken of here. This is a physical transformation of our planet using visible, observable, physical mechanisms. And so this is real.
Okay.
Is what I wish to say from my perspective. This is our reality that we are now subject to, and it is up to us to choose how we are going to deal with this reality. But our planet has been altered in terms of, you know, my background and how I'm involved in this. My background is in the technical sciences. I was a geophysical scientist. I've spent a great deal of my time in the outside world. I was also a surveyor, and their skill is one of measurement. And certainly these are some of the skills and traits that I have brought to bear simply because that happens to be my aptitude. Others will choose what is in their forte, but my background is one of observation, analysis, assessment, research. I'm a computer consultant at this point, so I often am thinking in terms of system analysis and certainly logic, as well as many things that are certainly not linear in this world, and I'm very much aware of that. So, you know, that's how I approach this, is as an independent researcher, is as a citizen acting in the public interest to call attention to what I regard, and many others regard, as a criminal act upon the inhabitants of this planet by physically and deliberately altering the very air that we breathe without our consent. And it, from my perspective, it certainly has nothing to do with, really, personally, I'm not attached to it in terms of the emotional response. Certainly we have one.
Right.
I feel very strongly about this from an ethical and moral standpoint. But the work that I present is done primarily of that as an observer, a recorder, an analyst, and a researcher.
Have we found samples that have been tested? Has anybody?
I have spent a great deal of my time conducting environmental samples. Why did I do that? Because when this was brought to the attention of so-called authorities, when this was brought to the attention of environmental agencies, when this was brought to the attention of any government official, the issue was dismissed, the issue was ridiculed, the issue was attempted to be marginalized. When an investigation was called for, you know, go back in the records and we will see what happened. That was another part of my job, was to document the record of public activism requesting an investigation on this issue. That's all they wanted. They saw what was happening. They said, do your job. Tell us what's happening. They were slammed back with either no response at all or one of ridicule or denial. And the common response is, everything's normal. What are you worried about?
Clifford, what are your samples showing?
In my case, there would be about three or four main components. The first would be the metallic salts just seems to be across the board. And it's a curious class of metallic salts. It's not just any salt. If you look at the periodic table, there's in groups one and two, there are elements there that are rather unique in their properties. And is there electromagnetic properties that are especially interesting? Salts such as salts made of barium, potassium, calcium, magnesium. These salts have a very interesting and unusual physical quality to them, and that is that they are subject to ionization with fairly low levels of energy, especially the energy that is inherent in sunlight alone. That's a remarkable physical quality that has tremendous and huge implications for the interpretation of what is likely going on with the introduction of these materials. So metallic salts are one dominant component, and if you look at my work, I'll go ahead and clarify this at this point. If somebody looks at my work, you will see a detection of or evidence and reports presented of unusual levels of calcium, magnesium, barium and potassium, with a special emphasis upon barium. I have probably written 24 papers on the barium issue. That is an extremely important element because of its toxicity. That is not a friendly element to our system in a soluble form. Another component would be that of a fiber. There is a filament that has repeatedly appeared. It is also most remarkable and unusual because of its properties. These filaments or fibers are submicron in size. To appreciate the scale, we mentioned submicron before, to appreciate the sense of scale, a human hair is roughly 60 to 100 microns thick. And asbestos fiber is a couple of microns. Bacteria would be on the order of, we'll call it 1 to 10 microns, and virus would be a submicron, this type of thing, somewhere in there. We're speaking of a submicron filament. Now, asbestos fibers are 2 microns in thick.
Mm-hmm.
Do most of us recall the attention given in this country to the environmental issues posed by the existence of asbestos in our environment?
Huge.
Many of us recall that. Okay. Would it not seem logical that if you had the repeated detection and presence presented, this is not, you know, this is not something that somebody is conjecturing. These samples exist. These samples have been delivered by certified mail to the administrator of the United States Environmental Protection Agency requesting straightforward identification on behalf of the public welfare.
And we don't get that, do we?
We do not get that. As a matter of fact, the Environmental Protection Agency did not even acknowledge the physical existence of this sample.
Let me ask you one quick question about these fibers, Cliff. Every once in a while, I'll wake up, I'll go outside, and I'll see what is not spider webs, but they sure look like them, and they're all over the place. Is that what these might be?
Most likely. I'll never try to make an assessment until I see the actual material, but certainly these are the characteristics. In fact, this is a common claim that was made. You know, I'm familiar with most of the counterarguments that are made. I actually consider the counterarguments quite carefully and dig into them, and the counterargument here is, hey, folks, these are just spider webs. What the heck are you concerned about? It doesn't fit. If you look at the data, it doesn't fit, okay? I've measured the spider webs. I've run considerable tests on spider webs chemically. They do not fit.
And it's a different pattern.
Well,
spider webs have different patterns than what I see.
Spider webs, you know, are a seasonal phenomenon, you know, that do not occur in clumps, you know, a quarter inch thick that you can deliver in a letter, you know, to the EPA and have them refuse.
All right, and here's another question on these fibers, because this is really incredible. There are a lot of people in this country, Clifford, who are complaining of a disease and they're not getting the attention that they should. And it's called Morgellons disease, and it includes some kind of little fibers that seem to be sticking out of their skin. They can feel it. It feels like there's an insect under their skin, creeping and crawling around. But there are little tiny fibers there. Maybe? What do you think?
I am familiar with that illness to some degree. I became aware several years ago, and I made my first reference to that in my work. At this point, there is no direct linkage that I'm aware of between the filaments that are airborne that have been presented to the EPA and the fibers that are inherent in the bodies of many people now, increasingly a number of people. That does not mean there's not a connection by any means. In fact, the sensible thing to do is to see whether or not there is a connection.
Right.
Because there are many, many interesting parallels that take place.
Well, and right now, mainstream medicine is denying it even exists.
Sure. They call the people delusional. In fact, this is one of the traits. There's three main things that are similar in this. You know, the first is that the issue of Morgellons, as well as that of the aerosols, there has been a very systematic, large-scale attempt to marginalize the issue and control the flow of information on it. The second is there has been a deliberate and systematic attempt to ridicule those people that present the evidence on it. And the third would be that there are some rather striking physical similarities in this material, especially at the microscopic range. If you recall, I'm telling you that these filaments that are airborne have been identified at the submicron level. There's no natural filament at that level. I've looked at every filament I can think of. You look at hair, I've looked at spider web, look at them all. They'll usually be about roughly 7 microns and above is where they start. The asbestos is the one that would be closest, down to 2 microns. So they ridicule the people and they ridicule the issue. And in addition, if you look at this Morgellons disease, I wrote a paper on this. In fact, you put one photograph up tonight on your site, mm-hmm. from the paper I called Morgellons First Observations. If you look at that, that is a single fiber. But if you look within the fiber, you will see a subseries of numerous fibers. And if you measure those fibers, you will see that these fibers are down again at the submicron level. So there is a rather amazing similarity between the physical morphology and constitution of these, and also the fact that the filaments, the airborne filaments, have been identified to be carrying biological components. And, you know, we mentioned the 7 things. You noticed I mentioned biological.
Yep.
All right. This comes from the fact that repeatedly environmental samples have detected the presence of unusual biological components over and over and over. And one should certainly, by any right of mine, one should consider whether or not there is a likely connection between unusual, unexplained submicron fibers that manifest in a disease form in the human body and the forced and continual breathing of air, which has been modified, and within it repeatedly detected the presence of filaments of similar form and nature. I don't think that's uncalled for to say, do your job again, tell us what we're dealing with.
So after you send the certified letter with samples to the EPA, what do you get? Anything?
What they did was they returned correspondence with a choice phrase, basically. This went on for a year and a half. Correspondence went on for a year and a half, with probably 3 or 4 letters, and every time the EPA would come back with a phrase saying, we are not aware. This was their phrase. Just as you have Mr. Gallus, who doesn't seem to remember very much. The EPA is unaware of any aerosol operations. This is what they'll say. They used the word unaware over and over and over. They did not acknowledge the receipt of that material, even though we know it was received. They simply ignored it. They made no reference. After 1.5 years, a Freedom of Information Act was filed by a third party, I believe apparently just trying to track down whether or not what I said had happened actually occurred. I think it was more of an investigative thing where they're saying, hey, EPA, did you really receive this material? It was at that time that the EPA returned the sample after this FOIA was filed. They returned the sample to us, and they made a statement that it is not the policy. Again, they used very interesting language, but they said it is not the policy of the EPA to test or identify any unsolicited material.
Jeez.
And that statement just blows my mind because if you look at that language, number one, they're resting their argument on policy. Policy is nothing based on law. Policy is a decision of whoever happens to be running the show at the moment.
If they asked you for it, they'd test it. But okay, since they didn't, they're not going
to
look
at it. And that's the other part that they have to ask me for. Besides being their decision, what they want to do, they also have to ask me for it. Go look at their mission statement and tell me if that's what the mission statement says.
No.
The mission statement of the EPA is to protect the welfare of our environment. It is a tax-funded government service for the public.
Bees,
that job is not being done.
Bees are disappearing, Clifford, all around this planet. Might chemtrails or, here we go, aerosol sprays have anything to do with it?
What are disappearing? I'm sorry.
Honeybees.
Oh, well, that's another interesting question. Okay, again, I try to be as accurate as I can, and that is, with the information that is available thus far, no direct linkage can be drawn between the disappearance of the bee population and the modification of our atmosphere. Okay, so that's the factual statement that we can make at this point. Now for the sensible interpretation. The planet has been modified in significant ways. It is not just the air that we are speaking of. These materials, these salts, affect the water supply, affect the soil, which in turn affects the food supply, and it affects life in general. Life and the planet is being affected. Now, if the planet was suffering damage, is it not expected that the life forms on that planet are also going to now be suffering? And is it going to manifest in a bee population? I don't know the specifics yet. We don't know that. And this is another thing. You know, this is a mystery story. You have three main mystery stories I'll introduce you tonight. One will be the mystery bees. The second will be the mystery malnourishment of the whale population.
Mm-hmm.
And the third will be the mystery aerosols. We haven't got to that tonight, but NASA has released a very interesting article, which they actually entitled The Twilight Zone. This is what they entitled it, talking about our very subject tonight, and I'll bring that up later if we get a chance. But here's the thing I cannot understand at all. These do not need to be mysteries. You cannot tell me that this world, this is not even a matter of this country, but that this world does not have the resources to dig into this issue of a bee population or a damaged whale population and identify the source of that when we can map every gene on any life form we want. It is ludicrous to me to think that these things are to remain as mysteries, which is how they are always presented in the media. We have no information.
You know, of these seven that you mentioned, it's also possible, Clifford, that all of them could be out there.
All of them what?
They're all being used.
Oh, in fact, that's my point in terms of coming up with this list. The point is that all of these are consistent with the data. In fact, that's how the list was developed. There was nothing that was included in the list that I have offered unless I look over all the evidence I have over years and I say, is this consistent, is this consistent, and is this consistent? And so the sensible interpretation here is that any or all or some are quite likely, if not possible, or let's say possible if not likely, are occurring.
Yeah. Well, next hour, we'll get into all these seven. Also, you've got Alan Huttner with you. I'd like to put him on for a little bit, too, next hour, if we can, Cliff.
And, yeah, unfortunately, George, he's now retired for the night.
So we'll let him go. But we'll get into these seven, because we're going to take a lot of time to get into this, Clifford. Then in the last hour, of course, we'll open up the phone lines. Can people email you stories or their thoughts through your website?
Certainly. CEC102@USA.com is the email address. I'm terrible at email, I'll confess, in terms of replying. I read everything, but I'm pretty rotten in terms of replying to everything. I just don't have the time for email. But I read everything and anything anybody sends to me. So they're welcome to send information to that address if they wish to.
Are other people jumping on board to research this? You know, we know a few. We've had them on the program. You were on many years ago, first time with me, and I'm glad you're here with me tonight. Other people beginning to jump on this bandwagon?
Well, in terms of the people that are aware, again, we don't have information because there is a deliberate attempt to constrain and manage information on this. But I don't think it's a stretch at all to say that certainly on a global scale, we are dealing with scores of millions of people that are aware of this issue at a very fundamental and real level. They know that this is happening. Now, in terms of who does what, you know, that may be a different story, but I'm certainly not the only researcher. In fact, you know, there's some that work on Mergellons. I'd refer people to Dr. Staniger, Hilda Staniger, and her work on this Mergellons, because she has been able to take that further than I have by far, and I'm very grateful for her work. Mike Castle has worked with her. There's a league of people that have devoted much of their lives. You know, it's not my choice to devote 7 to 8 years of my life to a crime. My desire was to call attention to it and have it investigated as it should be.
All right, stay with us, Cliff. We'll be right back with you. We're really going to digest these seven possibilities when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And our special guest tonight, Clifford Carnicom. We're talking about aerosol sprays up in the air. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Cliff, let's go through these seven that you had pointed out to us. We'll digest each one here. It'll probably take us the entire hour, but they'll be well worth it. Environmental matters here. Modification, perhaps weather manipulation as well.
Sure, George. Thank you. We talked about contrails and how they're physically composed, and we talked about clouds and what are the requirements for clouds to form. If you now introduce a third entity, that of the aerosol, it changes the dynamics of what's happening in a big way in the sky. remember that contrails require nothing except for moisture, basically, to freeze in a cold environment. Clouds require moisture and particles. Now, what if you were to introduce an extremely small particle, which is what they need to be for clouds, nuclei. What if you were to introduce a very small particle, and that particle had the ability and capacity to absorb moisture at very low humidity levels? What would happen?
If you would do that at very low humidity levels?
Absolutely. The operations are conducted essentially at flight altitude, roughly, 35 to 40,000 feet. There's people will say exceptions, but generally, high altitude in terms of aviation traffic is taking place. And the moisture at that level is generally quite low. This is why contrails form fine there.
Okay.
You do not need much moisture up there. But if you were to introduce a salt that can absorb moisture at very low levels, and there are some, and strontium chloride is the one that I have documented that will absorb moisture at roughly 30% humidity, okay? This changes everything because where clouds require moisture levels of roughly humidity levels of roughly 70% or greater to form, if you introduce a water-loving nuclei or small particle in a low moisture environment, it can create a phenomenon which we are now confusing as this grand mix that there's really no difference anymore between contrails and clouds. We create these things that we don't really know what they are, but we start conveniently calling them clouds, even though they're developing at the level of where cirrus clouds form, which are thin, wispy clouds. But suddenly we have an entire layer across the sky at 35,000 feet. You're changing the physics of the atmosphere in a way that is creating a new entity.
Maybe that's why it's so turbulent up there when we're in a plane.
Well, another thing, in terms of environmental modification and control, what happens then? Okay, you are affecting the moisture levels in a big way. You're attracting moisture, and essentially you're locking up the moisture in the atmosphere. And one conclusion would be that this is a quite feasible means of harnessing the energy of storm systems. I've done quite a bit of work to try and determine when these operations are actually taking place, and there's an interesting body of work involving ionization and humidity. But if you look at that work, the conclusion is reached that the most likely times that the operations are occurring in any given area are moments or periods of what you would call local low relative humidity. And the word local is real important because it means relative to what was happening before and after. It doesn't mean local in a low in an absolute
right.
necessarily, okay? And it's quite an interesting phenomenon, but down literally to the period of a matter of a few hours, over and over and over. I did this study for roughly a month and a half, measured ionization levels and humidity levels, and looked at that data very carefully. And this is a pattern that is emerging from that it's a very strategic time in which they are coming in. And it's not, as people claim, during periods of high humidity. If you look at the counterargument here, they'll say, hey, this is just normal and fine as could be. These things are going to happen when your humidity is high. These operations are not taking place when the humidity is high. They are taking place most often, what I see, immediately before and prior to entering humidity.
All right, then I assume they also then create rain with these false clouds. What's the purpose?
Well,
why would they do that?
Actually, I believe it's destroying the rain, George. It locks up that moisture.
All right.
It does not. We are losing our rainfall from this.
Okay.
You are locking up this moisture, and I believe harnessing the energy of that storm to use in other ways, which is where we get into the electromagnetic aspects, because these materials, as I mentioned, have the ability to be ionized or become charged through sunlight. And you start to change the dynamics of everything going on there. But sticking to the issue of environmental modification, one is that you expect the moisture patterns of the planet to be dramatically altered. And in general, you expect the moisture to be diminished. This is what you would expect. The second thing is that these materials, they're heating up the air. There's a lot of airtime and press which has been given to the notion that these materials are somehow in there for our good, even though we're not supposed to know about them. They're somehow for our good, and it's some benevolent program to inhibit or mitigate global warming. The evidence does not support that thesis at all. From what I see, these materials are heating up. It's based on heat, specific heat of a material. These materials are being dispersed into the lower atmosphere. A lot of folks are citing a report by Teller saying that, hey, he laid this whole thing out, and then this is what you do. You dump this stuff in the air. If you look at Teller's report, he did not say putting this stuff in the lower atmosphere. He said at the very least, the lowest place you would put this stuff would be in the stratosphere, 18 miles above, not 6 and 7 miles above the Earth. He says that the stratosphere is not a favorable location to be doing this, and where you really want to be doing is out in low orbit, roughly 150 miles away above the Earth, or 400,000 miles. The guy is talking about putting this stuff in space because it heats up, and you want to draw the heat away from the Earth. You don't put this material into a lower atmosphere as it is and expect it to be curing global warming. As a matter of fact, the evidence says it is as exacerbating and aggravating global warming, if not a significant constituent and component of the global warming.
Could it be causing droughts in the region?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's actually expected to be causing drought. If you put a desiccating material into the upper atmosphere that draws that water and holds it in and becomes basically an electrically conductive environment, you're playing with your weather in a very big way. You expect the moisture patterns, you expect the heat patterns, and you expect the wind patterns to be dramatically altered as a result of introducing this material, hence the likely agenda, one of many, but the likely agenda of environmental modification and control, but not for the purpose of mitigating global warming by any sensible interpretation of the data that I can see, but in fact aggravating and exacerbating the problem, if not directly contributing to it.
Fascinating. Biological. What are they doing there?
All right. If you look at these samples, it started with those filaments that we spoke of. If you look at these samples, you start to see a very unusual entity exist in those samples. And anytime I do something, it's not once. It's usually not one time. It has to be repeated.
All right.
Okay? You had these filaments come in. There was a medical professional in this area that was looking at these materials at the same time I was. I did not know that at the time. I was putting my work under the microscope, offering what I could. I started out with a $30 toy microscope when I first did my work, offered what I could to people. I had a individual contact me and said, Clifford, I'm seeing some things you can't see. Come down here and take a look. This individual had some of these similar filaments, if not identical filaments, that I had in my sample. And, in fact, his purpose for having me there was to have a second independent sample because he wanted to see if what was happening in his sample was happening in an independent sample. Because what he was seeing was some, sophisticated and advanced microscope equipment. He was seeing a biological component. Now, I'm going to say this outright because it's what he said. This was not my conclusion. This was his conclusion at the time. He said, my identification of this material is as a red blood cell. Now, that sort of blew my mind at that point, okay, because now you know if that's true, you're dealing with something really heavy here.
Absolutely.
All right? Because this is far beyond what anyone would expect. Now, at that point, I don't try to pass judgment right away. I try to get the data, and all I'm saying is this is what the person told me. We spent time under the microscope. What he needed was my sample to see if it had the same elements, components within it. The fact is it did, and that's what he was after, to find out if this was unique, a one-of-a-kind, or it could be corroborated with another sample. While I was there, I noticed something under the microscope that he had not seen that was even sort of more unusual, and that was a cluster development. Those photographs and all that work is posted on the site. The fact is that at that point, there was an initial discovery that said, We're dealing apparently not with just with unusual fibers, but it looks like we may be dealing with a biological aspect to these materials as an added component. My work probably went on for 2 years after that, I would guess, before I got some better microscope equipment and did more detailed work. My work has continued to evolve with limited resources. And I started doing some work which showed components also. And I'll make this short. It's a result of probably a two dozen episodes under the scope, each involving hours and hours and hours of work. But the work indicates the presence of erythrocytes on a repeated basis. Erythrocyte is a red blood cell. Now, what's different here, and this even goes back to the original sample, what's different and what made the work difficult and unusual for even this original person was that these components appear to be desiccated, meaning dried. His term that he used at the time was freeze-dried. They appear to be
freeze-dried blood cells.
Yes. The work that I have done indicates, I'm not a doctor. I don't claim to be a doctor. I put up my work and I say, this is what I see, folks. These are my photographs. These are my methods. What do we have here? I did it over and over and over. And if you look at my work, I will say, to the best that I can determine, visual identification, I'm real good at measurement, so I can measure size of things real well. The properties of the materials that I have identified satisfy the properties of a desiccated erythrocyte that can be reconstituted under a certain circumstance.
What does that do, Cliff, to you?
What does what do?
The red cells, if you inhale it.
I have no idea. I have no idea. I just, this is an observation. I'm, you know, these things, we should all be asking that, George.
Sure.
We should all be asking that question, right? And not only that, we shouldn't be asking them, we should be getting the answers. My resources are limited. Most of my work is based on my academic background with limited resources. It is obvious that significant and sufficient resources should have been and should be devoted to the direct answer to these questions. In my work, continually from the beginning, you see nothing but an appeal to say, this is what I find. Is this for real? Will somebody do this work and find out what the heck we're dealing with? It's across the board. There is a clear pattern of the work never being done, or let's say almost never being done. I certainly mentioned Standinger's work, and there may be some work being done quietly. But this is for the public. This is not something to be held in secret for a few to know. The public is being affected. The public deserves to know. You have serious environmental, health, medical, biological issues that are surrounding us in our environment that we deserve and need to know.
Incredible work, though, Cliff, I got to tell you.
I thank you. I'm not alone. There are others. I just happen to be a person who, let's say, presents my work to the public.
Okay, military, which was your third aspect, also, though, could be tied into all of them.
Well, yes, what happens, George, you know, as you look at these issues, the more that you study them, the more that you see a likely complex web of interacting and interwoven agendas. This is what appears to be most reasonable. And it's very difficult to draw some line and say, well, this is where it ends and it can't go into that domain. What happens when you start talking about military operations, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, does the military have an interest in conducting covert biological operations? Does the military have an interest in controlling weather for warfare? Of course they do. And so it is expected and really quite normal in a sense that you expect a military aspect to that. What is our indication that that's the case? One of them certainly has to be indirect. And that is if you look at who has shown an interest in my research. At a point when I had no public notoriety at all. When I started on my website, I was a very quiet person. Still am quiet by nature. But I was putting my material up in a public way. Nobody knew who I was. Who was it that was coming to look at my work? The military was all over that site in very serious ways. There is a list there. I stopped that a long time ago because a point was made. But there is a list that was accumulated over the first few months of work. They've now put things behind firewalls where no such things are impossible to do. But at that time, you could tell to a degree where visitors were coming from. There is a major effort and presence by the deepest aspects of the military in this country, apparently to monitor the progress of that research. You also have eventually a response by the United States Air Force when confronted with this issue. And their public declaration is that the entire issue that we are speaking of tonight is a hoax, that this is a hoax that has no reality. This is the Air Force official position. They say that that is corroborated by all of the basic significant media and academic institutions of this country. In doing so, they do not cite those media organizations, nor do they cite those academic institutions in their statement. But they do declare it as a hoax. Now, a rather interesting revelation that occurred some years later, this is probably about 2 years later, but if you look into the individual that was chosen to make that edict and pronouncement to the public that this was a hoax, not deserving of consideration, and certainly not involving the military in any way, you will find that that individual is a Colonel Gibson. Colonel Gibson. And if you furthermore look into Colonel Gibson's job performance, you will see that he is a master intelligence officer. That is his job. In the military, is to manage intelligence information at a extremely high level.
All right, Electra, we have in Alaska HAARP, that project that they're beaming for some reason. Could these aerosol sprays be tied into that at all?
Yes, they could, and they are expected to, actually. If we now go back and we examine that a little bit deeper, we talked about, you know, putting a submicron water-loving particulate into the atmosphere, right? And we mentioned that these materials, a certain class of materials, have the property that they can ionize with the energy of sunlight. That's pretty profound, really. You can't do that with just anything. These are rather unique. To think that you could expose something to sunlight. Somebody made a joke out of this one day, and they said, you put table salt out on the patio and it's going to ionize. They were making a joke, but the truth is it actually happens. If you look at magnesium salts from the ocean, and you actually get a mist that forms over them, there is an ionization that is taking place of those magnesium salts in the ocean. So it's straight physics, but you can look at the ionization energy that's required, and certain elements will satisfy this property. Barium is certainly one of these, barium, calcium, magnesium. But barium is certainly the ideal candidate here. And the physical tests indicate the presence of barium over and over and over. That's really my most positive confirmation that I have made and put the most time into because of the remarkable properties of that element. Now, what does it mean if you ionize something? It means it becomes electrically charged. Okay? When you're talking about a gas, the atmosphere is a gas,
all right,
and that gas can become electrically charged, it becomes what is known as a plasma. And I didn't know anything about plasma when I started this, okay? I go where the research goes, and this is where the work leads. If you ionize a material and it's in a gas, you're creating the components of what a plasma is.
And you can aim that, can't you?
The energy within that, I guess the first thing to acknowledge is that you now have created an electrically conductive medium.
Let's pick that up when we come right back, Cliff. Clifford, you were wrapping up your thoughts on the electro portion of these aerosols before we move into some of the other areas.
Yes, George, thank you very much. And
sure.
In some ways here we're tying together, number 3 and 4 in this list of electromagnetic and military. But to follow through on this plasma idea just a little bit further, first is that the definition of a plasma is that of an electrically conductive gas. The most familiar common example that most of us would know about that demonstrates what a plasma is about would be a neon light tube. That's exactly what it is.
Okay.
There is no bulb in that tube, but you have filled it with a gas that is basically an ionized gas, and if you send energy through that tube, what happens in that case? You get light. Okay. So you get a dramatic physical effect because of the introduction of, in many cases, a relatively small amount of electrical charge. Another example that we could use to bring things to closer to home to would be the ionosphere. Many of us are familiar with what's called the ionosphere. This is a layer roughly 60 miles above us. The actual charge on that, it's very small. In other words, a very small change in the electrical charge of a gas can have dramatic physical manifestations. And the atmosphere, the ionosphere in the upper atmosphere is one of those examples and completely, you know, revolutionized communication, allowed for the propagation of radio. It's a huge physical deal.
So do you think this is a communication tool?
Well, that could be only one. Basically, it opens it up. If you have an electrically conductive environment, it opens it up to the proposition of sending energy of some form, electromagnetic energy, from point A to point B. That's what it opens up. And it opens it up in a much more general way than just communication. Energy can be manifested certainly with weapon systems. Take the time, if somebody's interested in it, take the time to read the patent for by Bernard Eastland, which many regard as the blueprint for the HARP project. When I started reading that, a fair amount of it was slightly Greek, let's say.
Sure.
But I took my time with it. And if you look at the premises within that patent, they are a match as close as you can possibly imagine to just about everything we're talking about tonight. And you will see the Eastland patent talking about the introduction of barium into the atmosphere. You will see them talking about increasing the electron density, meaning the charge of the environment. You will see them talking about directing energy from point A to point B. You will see them talking about military operations across the board, one small one, of which would be communication. A much more grand one would be look into when he's talking about what's called a heave weapon. This is amazing, but it's actually possible. You know, this is conceptual at this point. This is what a patent is about. But the guy is talking about building up energy in this plasma state to the state that it could literally lift up the magnetic field of the Earth. They call it a heave weapon. And this thing is so grand that it's basically it's the same magnitude as an atomic bomb, a nuclear bomb. But there is no bomb, okay? It lifts the magnetic field of the Earth up. It's a tremendous amount of energy. And it can be used in an incredibly destructive manner. This is what's on the guy's mind. And it means that it makes sense from a physical standpoint for the patent to have existed. And many of us have good reason to believe that the technology invested in HARP is exploring, if not capable, of manifesting these technologies.
Sounds like they're grabbing a little bit of Tesla technology here, Cliff.
It very much does. Tesla is written in this all over the place. So if somebody wants an education, you know, take some time with that Eastland patent and look at the parallels. They're just across the board. Now, one other comment on this, the electromagnetic work. It was a lot of work again. It was similar to a biological work. It was many, many sessions over a prolonged period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a time when a major body of the work was done, and then I let it sit. A lot of times I'll let it sit, and then I'll come back, and sometimes it's a year or two later, and I say, is that still happening?
Mm-hmm.
Is this so deep and so broad that this is still happening? This is what happened on the biological side. It was difficult and unfortunate to accept that this appears to be a resonant situation. The same thing happened with the measurement and detection of what I would call ambient ELF energy. I developed equipment and built circuits and this kind of thing to ask the question of whether or not one could detect the presence of ELF energy in our environment. Now, what is ELF? ELF is extremely low frequency waves, extremely low frequency with corresponding wavelength. These are wavelengths that are operating in the range of roughly 0 to 100 hertz. Now, let's see, your light system in your home, your AC system runs at 60 hertz. So, but here's what's important in this case. Your brain works at roughly, call it 4 to 12 hertz. Okay? This is where human biology functions, is in the ELF range. And this is why when some of the initial work on antenna systems up in Wisconsin, they had one built for submarine communication. Submarine, they need to send these waves long distances. When you have a very low wavelength,
good point,
low frequency, you get a very long wavelength. So they use that to communicate with submarines. And a lot of people got riled up in Wisconsin when they started building that antenna because you're generating frequencies that correspond with the functioning of human biology. And so there was a lot of concern about that at that time. Now, my work was asking the question, is there resident or ambient ELF energy around us? It's a very difficult thing to detect. It's not really easy because you're usually dealing with antennas that are really long like the Navy would have. But I did this work, and I did it over and over, did a lot of experimentation. The result says the answer is yes. And it's not a question of once. It's not a question of twice. It's over and over. All the papers are there if somebody wants to see it. And the conclusion is that there appears to be resident or ambient ELF energy in my work, in a case, the conclusion is there's a fundamental frequency of 4 hertz. In other words, the lowest frequency that I find appears to be 4 hertz, and then multiples of it are found. So 4 hertz, 8 hertz, 12 hertz, 16 hertz. And the problem is that if this is true, it's saying it's around us all the time. It's clearly artificial in terms of when you look at the data, you see these steps. It's step data. There's no natural explanation that I can find for this. The Schumann resonance, if people wanting to get into that, is 8 hertz. You don't have something at 4 hertz that I know, because the wavelength would be basically twice the circumference of the Earth.
Could it hurt us?
yes, it could hurt us.
All these things could hurt us.
Yes, they could. I'm sorry to say they could. ELF energy operates at the same level as our brain. Therefore, it is quite conceivable that systems could be developed that could, let's say, interfere, affect, influence, or manipulate functioning of the human mind. It appears quite feasible that that's the case. Again, it would not be unexpected. And again, there is an adequate basis for an answer to this question. But the evidence says that it is there. And you know, it was a little bothersome to me that time because I waited like a year and a half, and I go, maybe things have changed.
Let's get into number 5, Cliff, and then 6 and 7, I never even anticipated, so we'll get into that too. But geophysical, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, this one is a bit more conceptual, but it had to do, and it has to do, with considering the amount of energy that we're talking about. What is it that's really possible here? And you remember when I was talking to you about the heave weapon, okay? It's H-E-A-V-E.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't imagine that when I started. But you're actually talking about a system that builds up enough energy to lift up the magnetic field of the Earth. This is a geophysical planetary thing, if this is for real, if you can do it. Okay? So the question is, what kind of energy levels are we dealing with here? And so I got into quite a bit of work there for a while to examine the question as to whether or not the energy that could be accumulated in this plasma state, if you accept my thesis that the conditions have been created for a plasma state in the lower atmosphere as opposed to the upper atmosphere, such as the ionosphere, then what kind of energy is possible to accumulate in that shell? And it was really quite interesting. Again, it's more conceptual. I have nothing direct. We're talking about Earth effects here. But the work led to the conclusion that it actually does appear as though it would be possible. It appears conceivable to me that you could accumulate enough energy in this plasma. And by the way, you do that by introducing ELF. if you dig up the equation for the thing, which is not all easy to find, not all that easy to find for, common folk to dig into this stuff, but if you get into plasma physics and you find the equations that govern the accumulation of energy in a plasma state, you will find that that equation is affected by the frequency. You're introducing energy into it. And you're asking, the resonance thing. You know when you're talking about Tesla?
Yes.
That's the idea, okay? You in a resonant way, you attempt to accumulate energy, and you'll find that that equation is dependent upon the frequency. And the lower the frequency that you introduce into it, the more energy that you can accumulate. So it becomes, of course, very interesting that we appear to have the discovery of a frequency much lower, you know, than even the Schumann resonance, which is an earthly thing. It's based upon the physical dimensions of the Earth. That if you put the numbers, you know, you work out the math of this stuff, the numbers come out that it actually appears, it's conceivable to me, if you introduce that low enough frequency in there, that you could actually accumulate enough energy where you're talking about literally geophysical and planetary operations. More specifically, the Earth is slowing down very slightly, very slowly. But if you look into the astronomy business, you'll find that the Earth is slowing down very, very slowly.
Well, you've done your homework. Surveillance, what do you mean by this one?
Okay, and my conclusion there, George, was that the energy we're talking about appears to be on par with the change, not the actual amount, but the change in energy of the rotation of the Earth. And if you further, if you look at the graphs of time, like they have the introduction of leap years, you'll find this very sharp discontinuity in the introduction of the leap years, which is time is a function of the rotation of the Earth. You'll find a very sharp discontinuity at the time that these operations started at the grand scale. So that's where that work. The surveillance, as we go along in these later categories, they become more conceptual because we don't have the physical resources, or I don't, to actually test them. I can only come up with a conceptual basis. But the surveillance one, I have not written this up on the site. The last two have not been written up, and they've come as afterthoughts in the work. But most of us are familiar with radar. And radar is when you send out a radio wave to an object, and it bounces back. Excuse me.
Sure.
And you detect this object, right?
Yep.
Okay. Well, radar, for it to work, the object has to be of a certain size. And it actually has to be a bit big. This is why ships and planes and this type of stuff works with radar. And it has to do with the wavelength of the object that you're detecting is on par with the wavelength of the medium that you're using to detect it, namely radio waves. Okay? Radar is an extension of the radio frequency range. And there is a match between the wavelengths of the radar that is used, radio frequency waves, higher end of it, or at least the end of the range, and the object you're detecting. Now, take that principle and investigate a phenomenon known as LIDAR instead of radar. And LIDAR is where you use light waves to detect an object, as opposed to radio waves.
So it's basically also for heavy security for us.
It appears, again, this is conceptual,
but it's
based on sound reasoning. The wavelengths that are tied in with light waves are extremely small, and they are on par with the size of the materials that we're talking about that have been introduced into the atmosphere. So it's quite conceivable to me that you can have a surveillance system based not on detecting a ship or a plane, but on detecting basically microscopic particulate matter. That opens up many interesting possibilities about, you know, individual identity, object detecting, you know, you're talking down to the cellular level possibly, right? It gets pretty deep in terms of the level of surveillance that could become possible there. Now, another reason this caught my interest, I can't really remember which came first here, but I came across a paper, and it was written by, I believe their name is the American Federation of Scientists. This is my best recollection. We can correct me if I'm wrong.
All right.
But this group, what they are is they're basically the think tank of the Manhattan Project. These were the folks that were behind the atomic bomb. And there is a legacy of those people. And they are in a group called what I believe is the American Federation of Scientists. Heavy-duty thinkers of technology and how it affects military systems and this type of thing. I came across a paper by these folks, and they were talking about nuclear weapons, and they were basically saying, well, you know, we've made some mistakes there. It doesn't look like it's so good for humanity. And then they were outlining what they thought was the most significant project in the future to develop. And you know what it was?
What?
It was a surveillance system based upon LIDAR.
Huh. Well, you may be onto something there, too.
So my argument is conceptual. based upon the, in addition to the published ideas, some folks that think in grand ways of developing systems that affect nations warfare and security and this type of thing. And it appears to be quite feasible to me that such a development could exist from this.
Another fascinating one, of course, the last one is the possibility that this is some kind of offshoot of some propulsion system up there.
Yeah, what it is, this is sort of, again, it's conceptual, but the generic term is going to be UFO. The technical term I will use will be detection of exotic or unusual propulsion systems. In the common language, that would be detection of a UFO. What it means is that if we accept that the ionic and electrical qualities of the atmosphere have been changed, and if you were to have a propulsion system that either uses that charge or influences or affects that charge, which I believe most systems would, any type of advanced propulsion system, I believe would likely be involved with ionic exchanges of some type. And or magnetic. It's quite feasible to me that if you have a system that could detect disturbances within that plasma state, that would be a very beneficial thing to be able to do. And to me, the principles are in place for that to happen. Again, I have no measurement, no detection. This is just more of a analytical conceptual examination of the problem. And it says to me it would be quite feasible that you could want to, if not develop a system that would be able to detect disturbances within that environment, besides the creation of the environment itself.
We talked earlier about whether these sprays are done during the daytime or nighttime. Why don't they hide it? Why don't they do it at night?
Well, this is the grand idea of, put something right in front of their face if you want to hide it.
Yeah.
We're at this state in the world now where I think it's difficult for people to distinguish reality from fiction.
They must cringe then when they hear programs like this.
I would hope so, at least.
Yeah.
I would hope so. But, this is out there. This is right in your face. But many of us are now accepting of the fact that we are being lied to on a regular and continual basis about very significant events in our world. And many of us are on our own or with our peers to try to make sense of this reality that we are now in. And this issue is certainly representative of those conflicts. All I can say is 7 years of research, not just by myself. I am one contributor, but the evidence is there for those that wish to examine it. This issue has demonstrated a remarkable capacity of people to deny a phenomenon which exists in their very face if they would choose to look at it.
Cliff, stay with us. We'll be back with phone calls, whistleblowers. And you can also tell us about this Twilight Zone project, what that means. We'll be back. Cliff, tell us a little bit about this Twilight Zone project. What was that?
George, thank you very much. This is an article which has come out on May 3rd, just this month of this year. And, you have a situation now where for 8 to 9 years you have a body of thousands of citizens, if not hundreds of thousands, but certainly thousands of citizens, that have been clamoring to have a stop put to the intentional and deliberate pollution of this planet and our atmosphere. You have a body which has continually called for an investigation as to the nature and purpose of these introduced materials, and you have nothing but denial, ridicule, and refusal by anybody purported to be in a position of authority. Now, and what is the basic claim? The basic claim is that our atmosphere is being saturated with particulate matter. That's the most basic claim that's being made.
Right.
All right? All right. On May 3rd of this year, you have an article issued by the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, specifically the Goddard Flight Center. And with your permission, I'd like to read two sentences. I know the problem with reading on the air, but I'd like, if you're able, I'd like to read two sentences from this article.
Okay, please.
As well as give you the title of this article. The title of this article is called Widespread Twilight Zone. Twilight Zone is in quotation marks. Widespread Twilight Zone Detected Around Clouds. Here's the two sentences. Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, documents for the first time that air around clouds that was previously considered clear is actually filled with particles that are neither cloud droplets nor typical dry aerosols, such as dust and air pollution. Worldwide, up to 60% of the atmosphere labeled as cloud-free in satellite observations is actually filled with this twilight zone of in-between particles, according to the study.
Mm-hmm.
This is amazing.
Well, good work. Let's take some calls, too. You ready?
Thank you very much. Sure.
Okay, here we go. For the rest of the hour, we'll take phone calls. First-time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Irene. I'm from Dayton, Ohio. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
God bless you both and for covering this topic, and especially you, Clifford. I have a question. I have been sick for nearly 3 years, which I believe might be chemtrail-related. I don't know. I used to live in Arizona where I worked outdoors as a tour guide, and I was being exposed to the chemtrails from 2002 onward. And then Labor Day weekend 2004, I went out hiking in the chemtrails. I thumbed my nose at them and said, I'm not going to let them control my life. I'm very obsessive about them, by the way, unfortunately. And I've been sick ever since with some strange illness. And I'm wondering if you know, Clifford, whether they've actually sprayed an actual virus or something that that gives you an illness that does not go away.
Well, you know, thank you, Irene. We're introducing the health issue here, which we haven't even really spoken of tonight at all. And I guess I would address it in a general sense first for the benefit of the audience, and that is there are huge health issues here. At the very least, you're speaking of mechanically ingesting particulate matter. Forget about what's even in it, just the fact that it exists. If you breathe particles of that size, they will increase the mortality rate. This is not me making this up. This is the American Lung Association. You will have a specific proportional increase in mortality relative to the increase in particulate matter in the air. That's at the mechanical level. Now, if you then venture into this domain of biological components, it gets pretty serious and pretty heavy, and most people don't want to deal with it. I can only report what I know. You know, the specific question, do I know of a virus? No, I do not know of a specific virus by name that is being introduced in an aerosol form. But I have an abundance and wealth of sampling and observations that show the presence of unexplained, unusual biological components in those samples over a repeated period of time. That is enough to justify the answering such as Irene is posing, is, okay, what are the specifics now? And where are those questions answered? They are not answered by the citizenry. They are to be answered by public officials that are acting in our interest, that are paid for with our dollars. It is those folks with the reach that have the resources and the means to answer the questions, and these are the folks that need to be put to the task. And it is not for the public to be assuming these duties.
May I ask another question?
Yes, you may.
Clifford, do you know of any medical doctor that actually treats chemtrail-related illnesses? I've gone to so many people. I've tried everything under the sun, naturally speaking. I mean, alternative medicine that I can think of that I've researched, and I'm at a loss. This thing has completely, it's really affected my life in a very, very bad way. Financially, in so many ways, and I just don't know where to turn. you know anyone.
At this point, I won't make, let's say, a specific reference by name, but I will make mention at this point, I think it may be helpful in a couple of ways, that I have prepared a documentary, produced a documentary. It's available to the public at cost. If George allows it, I'd give a phone number where that can be acquired.
Sure.
That's at 1-800-335-7226. Harriet Fells there will get a copy of the documentary to you at cost. There is no profit to be made with this documentary. The reason I mention this is because you will notice an extended interview with a naturopathic doctor within that documentary, and it may be at least a starting point for you to get some helpful information, if not contact an individual directly.
I understand, Clifford, that asthma is up over the last several years by thousands of percent.
The answer is yes. Let's ask ourselves, why are we hearing on the public airways, supposedly public service announcements, declaring that we have a new and extensive major disease in our presence, and what is that disease called? It's called COPD. Now, we didn't happen to run into COPD 5 years ago because it's basically an artifact of creation combining a multitude of respiratory ailments, including asthma. But COPD exists as the fourth leading cause of death, and we're being told to go to our doctor and get a COPD test and possibly the drugs for it. And do you know what the primary symptom of COPD, which, by the way, stands for a chronic obstructive pulmonary disease?
Asthma.
What's the primary symptom? Shortness of breath.
Yep.
Now, ask yourself, why are we in a state of affairs? Look at your smoking trends. The smoking trends are way, way down. You don't get to use that one. What is your explanation for a general condition affecting the bulk of the population where they are now expected to have a symptom of shortness of breath? Where is that coming from? The American Lung Association is putting out another one. I don't watch television, but I hear them on the radio, and they have a public service going for the National Health Association and American Lung Association, and they have another one out for lung cancer. And it's quite curious, in neither one of these public service announcements do they ever attribute any source to the problem. They simply identify it as a condition. And lung cancer is on the increase, no condition given, and no source for it given. And they even make the point that even though smoking has gone down, we are seeing a dramatic increase in lung cancer. Ask why. What are you breathing?
Next up, west of the Rockies, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good morning, gentlemen. Hi, George and Clifford.
Hi.
I'll be really quick in my lead-in, and I've got some interesting observations that I think I can share. And I fully agree with Clifford that, you know, the Earth is changing and contrails have a definite effect. And you can see that most obviously in the photographs taken from space that were done right after September 11th, when we had no aircraft other than military aircraft flying over the United States, and you could see a definite change in cloud cover. However, while I really appreciate his zeal and his intensity to want to find out what's going on, and I share with him his frustrations that the government is so offhand and brushes people off brusquely in their responses. I'm a journalist and a science and military journalist. I wrote the original story for HARP back in Popular Science in 1995, and I also have several thousand hours of being in the air as a air-to-air shooter with combat and high-performance aircraft and helicopters, being everywhere from sea level to 61,000 feet at Mach 2. And that some of the things I think that we see because of the nature of aircraft nowadays and because of the nature of the engines, some of the contrails look very odd. And you will see these donuts on a rope type things. And while I'm a guy who chases after black aircraft, I have seen the donuts on a rope form in the contrails in a 767 or a KC-135 tanker that I was right behind. I have seen... you also have, in Clifford's pictures, there are aircraft that have the appearance of a sheet of vapor coming off their wings. And that happens at certain altitudes, at certain pressures, at certain angles of attack. And once in a while, the entire aircraft will be enveloped as it's flying along in this sheet of vapor. There are also particulates, which Clifford very well explained how clouds and contrails, how they form and all that. A lot of older aircraft put out a lot of nitrous oxides and carbon and soot, so they also give stuff for water to form in and around. And some military aircraft watch themselves for whether or not they are forming contrails because it gives you away in the sky. Like if you're a stealth airplane, like the B-2, they have a little LIDAR in the back of the tail of that thing. It's looking for the contrails so they can find a place where they don't make contrails. And the military even went so far as to go to find stuff that would actively reduce contrails. That doesn't say that what he says isn't happening, but I certainly have seen things in the air that would tell me that some of the things that people attribute to chemtrails is not it. And I'll give you one good one here, and then I'll shut up, and you guys can ask me a question if you want. A couple years ago, I'm in a KC-135 aerial tanker. This is the aircraft that the Air Force uses with a boom to refuel other aircraft. I worked with the navigator and went with the cloud cover, and I lived in Juneau at that time, the capital of Alaska, and we happened to notice it was a great big, nice, clear hole there. So I brought the aircraft over the top of Juneau and got all sorts of chemtrail reports. And what it was, we were dragging six of the USF, the Air Force's Thunderbirds behind us, and I had them turn on their smoke generators when we were up at about 30,000 feet. So immediately this one great big aircraft flying with six streaks across the sky, I mean, I could certainly understand why people would interpret that as being something very weird. And the other one that I see that in your pictures, Clifford, you have some pictures of Iraq, and they have these racetrack shapes. Those racetrack shapes are the clear patterns of tanker and AWACS and communication aircraft that fly what are called racetracks there.
All right. You want to react to any of that, Cliff?
I appreciate the information that's given. I actually have no contest or disagreement with any of the information that has been provided. Life is full of exceptions, and there are circumstances which can be used to attempt to explain the vast body. I'm talking about a body of evidence, and that's the difference here. I'm not talking about exceptions. Life is full of exceptions, and we can go through those individual exceptions, and we can find certain cases where certain events can occur. They do not, from my perspective, in any way, accommodate for the massive body of information and evidence which has been accumulated over many years. As an example, if you will go to the EPA, actually the EPA and the Air Force, they issued a joint statement. They call it a fact statement. And it's supposed to set the record straight for the public as to, you know, what contrails are about. And you have about four interagencies, and they all put out a one-page statement. And you will see a classic statement used, a classic phrase in any of these so-called authoritative statements. And they will say, you know, contrails can persist for long periods of time if the humidity conditions are just right. But you know, not in one of these documents that I've ever seen do they ever state exactly what those conditions are. I've studied those conditions, and I can identify, I think, with a high degree of certainty what those conditions are. And they are the extreme exceptions to the rule, and they do not fit. They do not fit the meteorological database, which I have certainly dug into myself. And in this particular case of, you know, the unusual photographs that have been taken recently demonstrating some very asymmetrical behavior in the formation development of that trail under low humidity conditions, that was not an exotic aircraft by any means, and I'm not going to go into the specific of the tanker or the AWACS and this type of thing, but that was one of many very similar aircraft which quite often will have the appearance of commercial aircraft. I'm not going to say they are commercial, but they certainly have the appearance. The wing-to-wing phenomenon is not an extreme anomaly. It was a short period in the early phase of the operation where it appeared as though a method was being used, which was subsequently altered upon presentation of numerous photographs. I'm familiar with the theories and ideas that say that this is a you know, vortex condition, this type of thing. I've studied them. All I can say is the exceptions do not fit the massive body of data and evidence which has accumulated.
I got to congratulate you, Cliff, on the work you've done on this subject matter. I mean, extremely well done and thought out.
Thank you very much, George. I appreciate that very much.
We will take another quick call before we take our break, and then we'll come back with final calls. Hi there. You're on the air with us.
Hi, George, and hi, Cliff.
Hi.
I will say, too, thank you for the wonderful explanation. My Uncle Albert told us that those chemtrails were the airplanes emptying out their toilets before they landed. I thought it's good to hear the, you know.
Maybe in the beginning.
reason I wanted to ask is, would a ionizer in the home help with the air, you know, help us to breathe or help with the quality of the air?
Well, that's an interesting question, Cliff.
Yeah, I've actually done quite a bit of work with that, because if you look at my work there, you're going to find several papers related to measurement of ion counts in the atmosphere. That's not a real easy thing to do, and that equipment is not very affordable in most cases. I was able to find my way into finally getting an instrument. But I measured the ion counts and have some absolute values there. And the data shows an extreme imbalance, very unexpected numbers, very high towards the positive side. Life is not supposed to be full of negative ions or positive. It's a balance of both. That ratio is roughly in the order of 5 to 4, somewhere in there, slightly towards the positive side. The data shows an extreme skew towards the positive side. And I've done some experimentation with electrostatic filters. I would say, in general, that if you can create an environment that mimics that more balanced ratio in nature, that I think you will find your environment also to be improved.
So, stay with us, Cliff. We're going to be back with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest, Clifford Carnicom. Clifford, what do you do next? You continue the research. You don't give up, do you?
No, my work does carry on, although at, let's say, a more completed state. In other words, I have done the majority of what I am able to offer as an individual with my resources that I have. This issue doesn't reside with me. This issue resides with the inhabitants of this planet. My role has been primarily as a researcher to offer information and evidence of an intentional and deliberate change in our environment without our consent. So if there is an issue that I think that I can contribute further knowledge to with my resources, and if I have the time available, which is not the same anymore, I will do what I can always. But this issue is not my issue. This is our issue. This is our air.
All right, back to the phones we go. Wildcard Line, you're up with us. Hello there.
Yes, hi, thank you. This is Rick from Miami, and it's an honor to speak with Cliff. The power of intention. Today I was looking up at the sky and saw these chemtrails in the sky. And I remember George mentioning that there was going to be a program on chemtrails, and I was really hoping to get to tell them about Cliff Carnicom and the barium that he's found. And sure enough, Cliff, you're on the program tonight, and I am more than enthusiastic about it, but not about what you bring to the table, of course. My main comment is I'm a college student, and I looked at all the research that he's presented, and I'm wondering what methods we can use to awaken people, because, like he said, it's more than just this issue. It's a general sense of people being asleep. And the other thing I wanted to mention is he got me thinking when he mentioned the Manhattan Project about time and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered how the Philadelphia experiment plays in this and the Montauk Project.
Both good questions. Thanks. I'll let you listen on your radio. Of course, the Philadelphia experiment, Cliff, if you're aware of that, had to do with electromagnetic pulses, very similar to some of the things you've talked about.
I am aware of it just in a general nature, but, you know, I cannot begin, because my work is based on observation and data in terms of this role. I mean, I understand and accept many other let's say, aspects and components to life beyond just observation. But in terms of what I can offer to the public, I can't draw any direct linkage because, you know, the issue itself, the event itself, has its own controversy and its own physical principles and this type of thing. So I'm not saying no, I'm not saying yes, I just don't have any direct linkage. But clearly, I think that we are involved with manifestations of exotic forms of energy. I think that's a fair statement.
And in terms of getting the word out, programs like this, you got to just keep pounding away.
Yeah, that's right. It's difficult. I spent over a year making the documentary, and the documentary was my summary statement in a way that I hope is palatable to the general public, because I know we're very much a media-driven society these days. My website is pretty difficult to wade through because the papers evolved individually, and now we have quite a pile of individual papers. So the documentary is what I've offered as a summary statement for people to introduce themselves to this issue. And, you know, that's one offering that I can make. You'll see within that documentary that I do call upon each of us personally to engage ourselves in the way that is best suited to our talents, skills, and resources, and that's what I've attempted to do.
Very good. Next up, let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi.
Hi, George. This is Ralph from California.
Hi, Ralph.
And how you doing, Cliff?
Hi, Ralph. Thanks very much for listening.
I want to say that I had a relative that works for a big military computer company, contractor in Chandler, Arizona, and he was telling me what they were spraying is the new nanotechnology. It looked like the crystals that you explained, ground-up glass it looked like, but what they were trying to do is a way of spraying, and it dealt with, like you said, the brain has given a conductor, a wave of tracing people. He was told this, and then we had an international conference, and they asked him, will that affect our body? And he said, no, it goes in your system for about a day or two, and it comes out. But he had a high clearance. And I've been to the plant there. I've seen stuff, but I didn't see what he just talked about. This is about 2 years ago in the making. And he's saying that when he worked out there, every time they sprayed, they would get a film on their body when he was doing gardening out there, and he knew they were doing chemtrails. But it is a new technology, he said, that we were spraying. And the way he described it, he explained that to me the same way. I don't know the information about the technology, but he told me about this about 6 months ago, and it's real amazing.
Thank you, Ralph. You know, the information that you're offering is consistent, I would say, in the main with the scenario that I'm presenting from that of basically a researcher. It's certainly consistent with that. You know, nanotechnology is something that we are going to face and accept. It's here. The way I look at nano, you know, it's basically a function of size. There's a new addition to that I'm learning, and that is the element of literally artificial construction of machines. And that's where Dr. Stanage's work is very, very interesting, and people should follow up on that and listen to that because it expressly is about the introduction of nanotechnology with very unusual filaments. Everything there is consistent with the data, except for the statement about leaving your body in a day. It doesn't seem to fit the evidence that we have. I think we have chronic resident health conditions that now exist, and particularly if you get metals into your system, those things are not going to come out that quickly, and the memory lapse that many people have, respiratory conditions, I believe are an accumulated effect and not something that can be expected to dissipate within such a short time period.
All right, let's go to our next wild card line. Hello there.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Oh, I'm Nancy from Las Vegas.
Hi, Nancy.
Nevada. And if you guys want to see comtrails, boy, you ought to come to the city. They have been going really wild for about the last 3 months. I got a picture phone, a camera phone, and I've got like 50. Oops, can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay, I have about 50 pictures on my phone, and I almost saw two planes that were doing chemtrails the other day almost collide.
Yeah, it's almost like you can play tic-tac-toe with them.
Yeah, I've got all kinds of pictures. I've been emailing you. I've been fast blessing you.
Yes, I remember that.
And I've got like about 50 pictures that I could, you know, give you.
Well, you don't have to give me 50. Why don't you give me your best 10?
Oh, okay. And then it seems like since I live in Las Vegas, they do it on really clear days.
Yes.
And then it goes from like 9 in the morning to 5 at night. They're up there 8 hours a day.
Is that pretty standard, Clifford?
Oh, I think, you know, the logistics of this operation are one of the most difficult, I think, to figure out. Clearly, it appears to be a very sophisticated and difficult for any kind of immediate pattern to be drawn. I've certainly made mention of the most significant determination I can make in terms of when, and it does appear, from the best I can tell, is that the humidity, those local relative minimums in combination with ion counts also appear to be a significant factor in terms of where they are. But in no way would I even reduce it to that simplistic level, because I think we're dealing with very, very sophisticated and complicated logistics on this operation.
First-time caller line, your turn. Hello there. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Renegade. I'm rolling at you, actually, coming into L.A. tonight.
Well, you drive carefully. There's not that much traffic in the wee hours.
Yeah, but most of them are the crazy ones, too.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah. I got to thinking, with them using particles that easily ionize and convert to plasma, and given the military's history of addressing threats without worrying about the health factors, do you think that there's a possibility that they could be trying to develop some kind of barrier that might work on advanced technology, similar to the way an EMP works on our current technology?
Oh, I think that's a real possibility here. In other words, military applications usually go both offensive and defensive, and there's really no reason at all to restrict it to one side of that equation. And I think it's fully normal and expected that once you do develop some type of energy source or some weapon source, that you consider that from both a defensive as well as an offensive standpoint. So I think that's a very reasonable conclusion to make.
Okay, thanks, Renegade. Next up, east of the Rockies, you're up with us on Coast to Coast.
Hi, how are you this morning?
We are well, thanks.
This is Melissa from Niles, Michigan. I had a question. I was in the military out in California, and my ex-husband had worked on the flight line as a mechanic, flight mechanic. And I know that when the planes take off, if they have to do an emergency landing, they have to dump the fuel. What does that do in the atmosphere or just to the public in general? Because they don't tell you when they dump it.
I don't think it contributes as much as some of these aerosol sprays do, Cliff, but it is pollution.
Yeah, I would consider it as a localized affair to serve a particular purpose, with a highly volatile liquid. That would not be expected to have any major or enduring impact. That's what I would see as the release of jet fuel.
Do you think anybody will ever really go public and just say, this is what's going on, folks?
Well, we don't have that now, that's for sure. I can only go by the past. Certainly not, has not happened. You know, there are so many ways of managing and controlling information flow now that actually if you were to project ahead and imagine even if a person were to do that, you can have the most significant revelation in the whole world take place these days and people will pass it by in 10 seconds and go on to the next item on the entertainment network. That's unfortunate, but many people would not even realize the consequence of information when it's provided to them. And with very successful efforts at managing what I would call managing information flow and categorizing people, you can see that with the presidential candidates under debate. You will see very, very systematic manipulation of that information and pigeonholing of potentially valuable contributions so that they become nullified.
All right. The clock's going to get us soon, Cliff. Let's take as many as we can. You're up with us. Hi there.
Hello?
Yes, sir. Hi.
Yeah, Dell, Chicago. George and Larry, thanks for Coast to Coast. Where would we be without you? Trust Platform, I remember when you were also talking with a guy named William Thomas. He dropped out. You're still doing it. Congratulations. I have three other offerings to your 7-8 population control, 9 adapting the planet for an alien or alternative life form habitation, and 10 broadcasting diseases through the wavelengths that they're now using. What's very interesting is the other day I was out with six of my friends in an open area. We watched planes going from left to right, from east to west, west to east, and north to south. With the gentleman who called in earlier, if these were military craft, they sure were subjecting the civilian population beneath to all kind of problems. They were driving crazily. I think, again, that this is time when things like this should be talked about. The point is, what are you going to do about them once you understand it? Because now the whole planet is being changed.
It is. A population control possibility there, Cliff.
Yes, and, you know, in my case, that's a controversial issue. On my case, I just state the fact there, and that is more people are dying, will die, with increased population. Whether you want to call it an agenda or not, it is happening that more people will die. Now, to read into the deliberate, you know, culling of the population, I'm not saying yes or no. I will say that more people are dying, will die if you increase the pollution of our environment. In addition, when you have these biological components that are completely unexpected, I mean, bizarre. If you read one paper called Extraordinary Biological Observation, that one just still blows my mind in terms of what actually happened there. People will take a look at that paper. So, you know, the prospect for disease is all certainly implicit within the construct that exists here. There's always this line of, you know, what data do you have, because there's always somebody willing to, you know, have their threshold is reached, and everybody has their own threshold. I simply try to be reasonable and sensible in my presentation, and I am not one to eliminate considerations very easily, and I understand and am aware of those that have just been offered.
Why do you think mainstream networks aren't touching this topic?
Well, let's go back to this Manhattan Project. How is that to be handled? If you have a covert operation, you know, when people ask me questions, they want life simple, and they want the 5 W's, the who, what, when, where, why. They want all these very quickly.
Yep.
Okay, they want the snapshot. What I can offer to them in return is another question, and that is, if you could imagine yourself in control of the design of one of the, if not the most sophisticated covert operation on the globe, would you make the 5 W's available to your citizens?
No, but at least, you know, here we are with programs like this and a guest like you. We're talking about it on a network level, nearly 500 stations. It's all over satellite. Why don't they go out at least and try to interview people? Why don't they interview you?
You know, why does the mainstream media manipulate and control information? Because there is an agenda, need, and desire to manage people's state of knowledge.
I mean, I've seen the same thing they're doing just with, let's say, the Republican candidates.
Absolutely.
Where old Ron Paul's getting these poll votes after each debate, and now they're thinking about kicking him off.
Absolutely. It's another shining example, and that's what I was using as an example to refer to. You can have the most charismatic, accomplished, skillful leader that should ever exist in this world, and you will not find them running this country.
Well, Cliff, we're going to run out of time in about a minute or so, but I do want you to get that toll-free number out one more time and your website, sir.
Yeah, thank you very much, George. This documentary is offered at cost. It is not allowed for there to be a profit made with this documentary. The telephone number is 1-800-335-7226. There is a very kind and generous lady by the name of Harriet Fells that is making this available to the public, as well as another a distributed network across the globe, which people can access through the website, which is under my name. My research is under my name, carnicom.com, spelled CARNICOM. And it's basically a collection of my research for to 8 years. And I thank you very much for the opportunity to be here tonight, George, and to give a very thoughtful and fair presentation of information.
Very informed, Cliff. Thanks so much. We'll have you back again.
Thank you, George.
For Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Ross Mitchell, Alan Corbett, Stephanie Smith, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.